Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 23rd episode. Wild Trekker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This is the sixth episode of a seven-part series I call Dream World. This episode is devoted to The Grapes of Wrath, a novel written in the late 1930s by the American novelist John Steinbeck. In the 1930s, severe drought ravaged the American prairie. Drought brought on by the way tenant farmers deep plowed the topsoil, exposing it to relentless winds. The drought then transformed the region into a dust bowl, with black clouds of dust billowing over the land, blocking out sunlight, filling farm buildings, and leaving bedraggled sharecroppers gasping for breath. The banks repossessed the land from these tenant farmers because it was no longer productive. In any case, a single man driving a tractor could do all the work previously done by an entire family. As a result, hundreds of thousands of farming people in Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, and other states were thrust out of their homes. They sold off whatever their household items could bring, and they headed west to California, lured on by handbills promoting the work to be obtained there, picking fruit and cotton. This is the background to Steinbeck's novel, which he based on a series of newspaper articles, The Harvest Gypsies, which he had written in 1936 for the San Francisco News. The series of newspaper articles does not identify any characters. It quotes people anonymously in a generalized, representative sort of way, and it is largely thematic. By today's standards, the series is a long-form essay in several parts, rather than a news story or feature. Steinbeck and the San Francisco News must both have judged that he would be putting individual lives at risk by identifying victims of injustice who were ready to come out on the record. The Harvest Gypsies helps understand the themes of the later novel, whereas The Grapes of Wrath is a fictionalized account of a people in flight, a novel with an epic panoramic sweep, full of rage and pathos, evoking the horrible colors of death and an incredible range of powerful emotions from shame to fear, desperation, love, desire, terror, and bitter resignation. In fact, The Grapes of Wrath is about modern-day slavery, something Steinbeck is convinced should not be allowed to happen to American-born citizens. Steinbeck's novel bears some comparison to the USA trilogy by John Dos Passos, which was the subject of my previous episode of Dreamworld. Both authors base much of their narrative on previous work they had done as journalists during the 1930s. Then again, both authors address shocking, brutal injustice in the United States, giving a voice to the voiceless. Dos Passos focuses on the working class, perpetually caught in the mostly urban context of the blind and indiscriminate exercise of power. Steinbeck, for his part, brings alive the hopes and agony and degradation of rural life, of the Jode family as they're torn away from their land, then thrown out onto the lonely highways and byways of Southwest America in search of their lost dignity and identity. There are both haves and have-nots in the USA trilogy and the Grapes of Wrath, but the have-nots are the only ones who get a hearing. The haves are brutal and self-interested and don't deserve a hearing. Both Dos Passos and Steinbeck show one perspective and one alone. Their heroes are victims of injustice who bear no responsibility for what is happening to them. Instead, they are dominated by big capital and corrupt politics, by dark, faceless, impersonal, disembodied forces. Steinbeck even refers to the bank as the monster. Finally, Dos Passos and Steinbeck both write their fiction in order to draw public attention to injustice, so they're seeking to persuade readers. Dos Passos is innovative in his juxtaposition of diverse narrative elements, from dialogue to stream of consciousness, and short biographies of leading public figures to newsreels consisting of excerpts from the press. The USA trilogy comes off as an amazing experiment in language, where the reader is constantly jolted back to face the political message Dos Passos wants to deliver. I should say right off the top that the language in Steinbeck is gorgeous and far more evocative than in Dos Passos. Language is a huge part of the story. Steinbeck also weaves together different modes of narrative, from passages describing nature to dialogues, expository passages to prophetic writing, and what I would call inner dialogues, that is, implied conversations between people, like thoughts passing from one person to another, without the quotation marks. The Grapes of Wrath starts off with nature, which for Steinbeck is animated. And by the way, when I do readings in this podcast, I'm not going to try to imitate a Californian or Oklahoman accent. The wind grew stronger, whisked under stones, carried up straws and old leaves, and even little clods, marking its course as it sailed across the fields. The air and the sky darkened, and through them the sun shone redly, and there was a raw sting in the air. During a night, the wind raced faster over the land, dug cunningly among the rootlets of the corn, and the corn fought the wind with its weakened leaves until the roots were freed by the prying wind, and then each stalk settled wearily sideways toward the earth and pointed the direction of the wind. And the wind cried and whimpered over the fallen corn. In The Grapes of Wrath, the reader gets used to a new kind of American speech, to the rhythms of folksy English the way it is spoken in rural Oklahoma. Steinbeck's characterizations are captivating. His characters are not flat, as in Dos Passos. The Jode family, like many other families of tenant farmers, find themselves dispossessed, driven off the land which provides the family with dignity, a sense of identity, and a way of life. It is everything or nothing. They are right at the edge of the precipice, about to go into free fall. First is Tom Jode, the eldest son, who has just got out of prison for killing someone in self-defense. He gradually changes from being very self-involved at the beginning to developing an ethic of solidarity. Then comes Ma Jode, who initially seems to play a deferential role. That is, after all, the way women were expected to appear alongside their husbands in patriarchal families. But she proves to be the backbone and main caregiver of the family, and she's also the one making the key life-or-death decisions. Jim Casey is a former preacher who has come to regret having abused that role by lying in the grass with so many girls. He has lost faith, but he's come to believe in something new. The Oversoul, that great community soul of which everyone is a part. He may not be religious any longer, but he's discovered a new spirituality, and he ends up sacrificing himself, like Jesus Christ on the cross. Rose of Sharon Jode is a giggly, naive young woman, expecting a baby with her dreamer husband, Connie, but in a moment of crisis, he wanders off, and she's left to fend alone. The baby is stillborn, blue, mummified, and in the closing scene, she offers her breast milk to a stranger, starving to death. There are a few other characters. These characters are set against the Dust Bowl, which comes as an apocalyptic blow to the family unit. They struggle to stay together as a family and to help each other survive. In chapter 5, Steinbeck writes, "The owners of the land came onto the land, or more often a spokesman for the owners came. They came in closed cars and they felt the dry earth with their fingers, and sometimes they drove big earth augers into the ground for soil tests. The tenants, from their sun-beaten dooryards, watched uneasily when the closed cars drove along the fields, and at last the owner men drove into the dooryards and sat in their cars to talk out of the windows. The tenant men stood beside the cars for a while, and then squatted on their hams and found sticks with which to mark the dust. In the open doors the women stood looking out, and behind them the children, corn-headed children with wide eyes, one barefoot on top of the other barefoot, and the toes working. The women and the children watched their men talking to the owner men. They were silent." When the Jodes find out they're going to be kicked off the land, their first reaction is rage, but it is impotent rage. Steinbeck writes, "The tenants cried, 'Grandpa killed Indians, Pa killed snakes for the land. Maybe we can kill Banks. They're worse than Indians and snakes. Maybe we got to fight to keep our land like Pa and Grandpa did.' And now the owner men grew angry. 'You'll have to go.' 'But it's ours,' the tenant men cried. 'We know the bank. The monster owns it. You'll have to go.' 'We'll get our guns like Grandpa when the Indians came. What then?' 'Well, first the sheriff and then the troops. You'll be stealing if you try to stay. You'll be murderers if you kill to stay. The monster isn't men, but it can make men do what it wants.' In fact, the entire Jode family are replaced on the land by a single man driving a tractor. Advances in technology have rendered the Jodes irrelevant. They find this very degrading. The Jode family dream of exchanging their suffering and loss in Oklahoma for the bountiful paradise of California. They're cheated by a fast-talking used car salesman, then by someone buying off much of their household effects. They're hard done by. They don't understand what's happened to the land in Oklahoma, why as tenant farmers they've been booted off the land, where they should go in order to survive, and whether it's true that California is a land of abundance, where work is plentiful and you only have to pluck oranges off a tree. There's something biblical in the Jode family's subsequent trek across America with the last of their household goods, and their ramshackle truck loaded up with family members, a few pigs, and John Casey, a former preacher who's lost faith. Are they headed for earthly paradise? Is that what they believe? Are they headed for the promised land instead? In chapter 18, Steinbeck describes the arrival of the Jodes in California. It's a moment reminiscent of the exodus of the chosen people and the view Moses must have had from the summit of Mount Nebo out over the promised land. Here's the passage. Tom said, "Jesus, the desert's past. Pa, Al, for Christ's sakes, the desert's past." "I'm too goddamn tired to care," said Al. "Want me to drive?" "No, wait a while." They drove through Tehachapi in the morning glow, and the sun came up behind them. And then, suddenly, they saw the great valley below them. Al jammed on the brake and stopped in the middle of the road. And "Jesus Christ, look," he said. "The vineyards, the orchards, the great flat valley, green and beautiful, the trees set in rows, and the farmhouses." And Pa said, "God Almighty, the distant cities, the little towns and the orchard land, and the morning sun golden on the valley." A car honked behind them. Al pulled to the side of the road and parked. "I want to look at her." Steinbeck mentions the 19th century massacre of Indians in America, and this is significant. He presents American history as a series of migrations across the land, of rivers of migrants surging westwards, of haves booting out have-nots. So this injustice is nothing new. What is new in the case of the Oklahomans is that they are white Americans, people of British, Scandinavian, and German ancestry. Once they're dispossessed, they're reduced to the level of peons on the edge of starvation. They have nothing. Their social and family world is disintegrating. Their future is bleak. They are kicked around by greedy landowners and private armies of vigilantes. What exactly is a peon, you ask? Well, it's a Spanish-American day laborer or unskilled worker with no job security, scrounging for work, scratching out an existence in a hovel, a ditch, an improvised shelter, dependent on short-term work harvesting crops in someone else's field, and subject to malnutrition, not to mention starvation. For Steinbeck, the Oklahomans are treated little better than slaves. The America that Steinbeck presents is in stark contrast with the American dream. In 1931, James Truslow Adams coined the term the American dream, and he did so just a few years before The Grapes of Wrath came out. Adams writes, The American dream is that dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for every man, with opportunity for each according to his ability or achievement. It's not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they're innately capable, and be recognized by others for what they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position. The national ethos of the American dream triumphantly proclaims democracy, rights, liberty, opportunity, and equality for all. Instead of the American dream, the Grapes of Wrath presents the American apocalypse. The Oklahomans develop a locally based spontaneous democracy, it's true, where everyone, or almost, works for the good of all, and they live out this democracy on the farm before they leave, on the road west, and in a government camp in California, where they find relief. They're part of a resilient folk culture. But the Oklahomans find themselves exploited as a new underclass in California, reduced to apocalyptic starvation day wages picking fruit. They're liable to be beaten up, kidnapped, or murdered, fenced in on private ranches which seem like concentration camps run by fascist thugs, and kicked out as soon as the harvest is brought in. By the time the Joads reach California, by the time they discover the enormous rift between their dreams and the reality in that garden state, they're condemned to live in the ditch, behind bushes, in shacks made of weeds. And Steinbeck now represents the land in very different terms, because the land has been corrupted by a criminal system. The decay spreads over the state, he writes, and the sweet smell is a great sorrow on the land. Men who can graft the trees and make the seed fertile and big can find no way to let the hungry people eat their produce. Men who have created new fruits in the world cannot create a system whereby their fruits may be eaten. And the failure hangs over the state like a great sorrow. The works of the roots of the vines, of the trees, must be destroyed to keep up the price. And this is the saddest, bitterest thing of all. Carloads of oranges dumped on the ground. The people came for miles to take the fruit, but this could not be. How would they buy oranges at 20 cents a dozen if they could drive out and pick them up? And men with hoses squirt kerosene on the oranges, and they're angry at the crime, angry at the people who've come to take the fruit. A million people hungry, needing the fruit, and kerosene sprayed over the golden mountains. And the smell of rot fills the country. Burn coffee for fuel in the ships. Burn corn to keep warm, it makes a hot fire. Dump potatoes in the river and place guards along the banks to keep the hungry people from fishing them out. Slaughter the pigs and bury them and let the putrescence drip down into the earth. The Joads hoped to find an earthly paradise in California, the solution to all their problems. Instead, they find a harsh land where big capital and corrupt politics conspire to transform them into an underclass of peons. So from a naturally democratic community of families, all part of the oversoul, they're transformed into an underclass. For Steinbeck, the American apocalypse is depriving the Joads and hundreds of thousands or maybe a million people like them of their birthright as white Americans, as citizens of a democracy. And this apocalypse is depriving them of their very lives and may well lead to a social revolution. Steinbeck writes in The Harvest Gypsies, on which The Grapes of Wrath is based, "The will of the ranch owner, then, is law. The landowners in Imperial Valley, California, use fascist methods of terrorism against the migrant workers. The receding waves of foreign peon labor, that is, the Filipinos, Japanese, and Mexicans who used to pick fruit, are leaving California agriculture to the mercies of our own people. The old methods of intimidation and starvation, perfected against the foreign peons, are being used against the new white migrant workers. Steinbeck notes in The Harvest Gypsies that the migrants are held in check by vigilantes, by deadly fascistic groups which preach and act the overthrow of our form of government by force of arms. Moreover, Steinbeck writes, if the terrorism and reduction of human rights, the floggings, murder by deputies, kidnappings, and refusal of trial by jury are necessary to our economic security, it is further submitted that California democracy is rapidly dwindling away. Fascistic methods are more numerous, more powerfully applied, and more openly practiced in California than any other places in the United States. I would like to say a few words about the apocalypse, which has directly inspired Steinbeck's storytelling. First, the title of the novel, The Grapes of Wrath, which comes directly from the book of Revelation, or the apocalypse, at the end of the New Testament. I'll quote here from the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, which I prefer to the King James Version. So the angel swung his sickle on the earth and gathered the vintage of the earth, and threw it into the great wine presses of the wrath of God. And the wine press was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the wine press as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. So in this passage is the original source of the title, The Grapes of Wrath. Steinbeck takes on a prophetic tone, but what exactly is he doing? Apocalyptic prophecy goes a long way back. The Jewish biblical scholar André Neher has identified four kinds of prophets in the ancient Near East. The first and lowest kind of prophet dwelled in the realm of magic. The second was more concerned with social ideals and used prophecy to make his claims for justice better known. Then there was the mystical prophet, and finally the apocalyptic prophet. For Neher, the prophet concentrates in his person all the intensity of the fiery struggle between light and darkness, between good and evil. As a result, to be a prophet means to be weighed down, deprived of freedom, martyred, to have experiences which free the prophet of the human illusions of liberty and autonomy and make of him a more complete man. Neher is particularly eloquent in writing of Jeremiah's captivity. Indeed, exile, the rift between the self and its native place, is common to much apocalyptic prophecy, whether it be Jeremiah himself in Babylon, John in exile on the Isle of Patmos, or even Dante, disconsolate after being expelled from his beloved Florence. The tension of forced separation only heightens apocalyptic consciousness. According to this classification, Steinbeck is somewhere between a social prophet, using prophecy to make his claims for justice better known, and an apocalyptic prophet, as the title The Grapes of Wrath implies. But the apocalypse Steinbeck evokes is not a particularly religious one. It is more of a secular apocalypse, and it's also very much an American apocalypse. When Steinbeck takes on a prophetic tone, it means the story he's telling demands to be heard. He dares to tell the story in full detail, holding nothing back. This confers on him the power to interpret, to share his vision, to reveal, to denounce, and to foreknow. This prophetic tone also enables him to hold readers spellbound. There's another source of the title of the novel, for these words, the grapes of wrath, when quoted from the Bible, find their way into the American hymn, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which is abolitionist, that is, written to denounce slavery in the mid-19th century. This hymn predicts that greedy, exploitative slave owners will one day pay for their crimes. Over time, the Battle Hymn of the Republic became a patriotic song, and its anti-slavery message was mostly forgotten. Steinbeck's message is that the struggle of the Oklahomans in the 20th century can be compared to the struggle of slaves in the 19th century. The Jode families and other American migrant workers have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's written right there in the Constitution. But this right is trampled by the big landowners of California, the hoarders of land, the greedy exploiters who want to transform the Oklahomans into a dependent underclass of peons. And the big landowners will one day pay for their crime. It's a crime of the concentration of wealth, consumption, and waste, which is simply killing people. As Steinbeck writes in chapter 25, there's a crime here that goes beyond denunciation. There's a sorrow here that weeping cannot symbolize. There's a failure here that topples all our success. The fertile earth, the straight tree rows, the sturdy trunks, and the ripe fruit. And the children dying of pellagra must die because a profit cannot be taken from an orange. And coroners must fill the certificates, died of malnutrition, because the food must rot, must be forced to rot. The people come with nets to fish for potatoes in the river, and the guards hold them back. They come in rattling cars to get the dumped oranges, but the kerosene is sprayed, and they stand still and watch the potatoes float by, listen to the screaming pigs being killed in a ditch and covered with quicklime, watch the mountains of oranges slop down to a putrefying ooze, and in the eyes of the people there's the failure, and in the eyes of the hungry there's a growing wrath. In the souls of the people the grapes of wrath are filling, and growing heavy for the vintage. Of course, when heavy rains come to California at the end of the harvest, the Jodes have to contend with flash floods and the onset of winter. I've mentioned different kinds of narrative structures in previous Evidencia blogs and Wild Trekker podcasts. This is one of my theories. For example, the linear narrative going from A to B to C, like a long piece of string pulled out in a straight line. Then the idealized narrative. Perfect, unblemished, like a sky blue ball or sphere. Then the complex narrative, like a sand or desert rose, a multifaceted riot of gypsum crystals facing every which way. I find that desert rose metaphor fits the USA trilogy by Dos Passos. The narrative structure in Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath is more like woven tresses or a girl's long braided hair or rope. It keeps moving along and you keep coming back to familiar themes. Then you lose sight of them. Then you come back to them again. Action is relayed from one character to the next, seamlessly, from a truck driver to Tom Joad, who's just got out of jail, to the people Tom meets as he finds his way to a home which his family has just abandoned. This action is all conveyed like a slow pan in a movie. Steinbeck takes his time weaving a fabric, a context, a collective point of view of rural Oklahoma. At the same time, he uses another cinematic device, zooming in to focus on detail, then zooming out to set families against the backdrop of nature to get the big picture. These zoom-out sequences, sometimes called intercalary chapters, represent about 1/6 of the entire novel. Steinbeck also uses the literary technique of foreshadowing. He occasionally hints at what's coming. He doesn't always do this to create dramatic tension. Foreshadowing is more like a series of teasers dropped throughout the work. For example, Tom Joad is only out of prison on parole, and if he leaves Oklahoma, he's liable to be arrested and sent back to jail. But nobody ever pays attention to this fact. A land turtle gets run over by a car, but then rights itself and wanders off into the bush, only to turn up again under Tom Joad's clothing. Then again, a group of vigilantes try to provoke a riot in a government camp in California so they can move in and burn the camp, booting migrant workers out. But the migrant workers get advance word of the plot and manage to avoid the riot, so there's no problem finally. Of course, one of the big themes of the novel is the long shadow cast by imminent death itself. Death due to a stroke, to unnamed illnesses, to starvation. And death is described in detail. This is another example of foreshadowing. You see death coming from a long way off. Well, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed this podcast devoted to Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. I'll be back soon with the final episode of this series of podcasts I call Dream World. The next episode will be devoted to Lo Realismo Mágico, Latin American Magical Realism. If you'd like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net, and Evidencia is spelled Evidentia, that's N as in November. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker episode is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Demeul on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.